Howdy, and welcome to The Stoop. This is Cutter Gonzalez, your host. We have our first ever three-guest episode today, featuring Matt Mushin, Grace Murray, and Nick Taylor from New Hampshire. We usually try to limit the number of guests on the show to ensure every single guest has adequate space to share their stories. But I was encouraged to have these three on by my colleague Allison McIntosh, and she promised that, one, I wouldn't be getting the whole story without all of them. Two, having them on together would give us deeper learnings than trying to pick just two of them. And three, I would adore all three of them, especially together. Allison was right, as always. These are three of the most generous, thoughtful, and fun people to spend time with and learn from. And I can confirm, post-Yimby Town, where we all got to hang out in person, they're even cooler in real life. After talking, I'm also sure we'll have them on again. More Pro Homes wins are absolutely ahead in New Hampshire. Before we get to the conversation, though, here's a bit of background on their work individually. Matt Mushin, he/him, is the program director of 603 Forward, a nonprofit organization working to build the next generation of leadership in New Hampshire. In this role, he leads the charge to connect and strengthen the organization's programs, ensuring they keep building momentum and driving change in the state. Between training folks to speak up for issues they care about, to finding young leaders to run for every office in New Hampshire, Matt envisions a state that draws in young people and gives them a space to thrive. Grace Murray, she/her, is the political director of New Hampshire Youth Movement, a statewide advocacy organization focused on the issues affecting the young people of New Hampshire. Affordable housing options, student voting rights, and LGBTQ+ protections are the primary issues focused on by NHYM. By educating students on the issues affecting them, NHYM empowers students to talk to and organize their peers to make the state a place where young people can thrive. Grace believes young people are the key to creating lasting change in the state and has been organizing college students in New Hampshire since she was a student in 2018. She also lives in Amherst, New Hampshire. Nick Taylor, he/him, is the executive director of Housing Action NH, a pro-housing advocacy organization that supports increased access to housing. Housing Action NH advocates across the housing continuum from emergency shelter to attainable market housing options. Over the last decade, Nick has worked on a wide range of public policy, political, and advocacy issues. He lives in Manchester, New Hampshire. And a quick note, we recorded this episode pre-Yimby Town, which is the national gathering of pro-housing advocates. That took place mid-September, but we'll know information about next year's convening before too long, and I'll be sure to include that on the show, so stay tuned. And without further ado, let's hear what they had to share about their recent work in New Hampshire. All right. Hey, Grace. Hey, Nick. Hey, Matt. Welcome to The Stoop. So glad to have y'all on today. Most of us have only just met, and you're our first ever group of three on The Stoop, so this is going to be really fun, and we're going to figure it all out as we go. But you're all lovely people and come highly recommended from people I love also, so I have no doubt this is going to be great. But just for the sake of, like, getting introed and associated names with voice, because that is definitely not going to be clear from my intro, can we start and just give, like, your name, of course, your pronouns, and then, you know, kind of how you came to the work, what your role is. And let's go ahead and start with Grace.
Thanks, Cutter. Yeah, my name is Grace Murray, she, her, and I'm the political director at New Hampshire Youth Movement. I came into housing work specifically. I honestly just kind of fell into it. I'd been at New Hampshire Youth Movement for a number of years, and housing was one of the issues we had been focusing on because it's really impacting the young people of New Hampshire. And I've really enjoyed learning so much about how it intersects with all the other issues that I care about. And really just hearing people's stories and being able to make change. And honestly, doing housing work is just, like, so great because I love New Hampshire so much. And I think that everyone should be able to live here if they want to. So yeah, that's kind of how I got into this.
I love the, like, the New Hampshire propaganda, because I'm like, I joke that I'm an Austin propagandist, right? I'm like, even when it's like 100 degrees, I'm like, but wait, you can go swimming. It's so great. It's okay. It doesn't suck, I promise.
And that some days I'm a little more dumb, but I love that. I guess let's go to Matt.
Awesome. Hey, Cutter. Thanks for having us on. My name is Matt Mushian. I use he, him pronouns, and I'm the program director with 603 Forward. And yeah, I really kind of found myself in this space too because of the membership of 603 Forward. I always tell folks it was literally my first week on the job, having one-on-ones, talking to folks, just like getting to know people. And like every person I talked to named housing, affordable housing, their ability to find a place that was safe and affordable as one of their top issues. And for us, it's all about building a New Hampshire that folks have the ability to thrive and stay in, and don't have to make tough choices about where they're going to live. So yeah, I'm excited to talk about some of the stuff we have going on too.
Yeah. And to round out the three voices that you'll hear for our guests, I'm Nick Taylor. I'm the director of Housing Action New Hampshire. We're a statewide advocacy organization working on state and federal policy. And we work actually from the homeless shelter space all the way up until some of these market reforms that allow for more attainable housing options. And really excited to share our New Hampshire propaganda here. The good, the bad, the ugly. You're going to be wanting to come here, wanting to move, be part of this by the end of this conversation.
I have actually never been to New Hampshire myself. And so I'm like already convinced because, you know, you're like probably not 96 degrees today while we're recording this. Or maybe you are. I've heard there's been kind of hot weather this year up in the north.
The summer and the fall is the time for you to come up here and we'll get you up for a tour.
Yeah, I got to do it.
The first live audience, the first live audience podcast, right, it will come. Right.
I love that. I love that. And Nick, you and I know each other from when I first got hired at WNN. Very briefly, we were talking before the call about how that was like, I had no idea what I was doing. The network was like so much smaller than two, and it like really wasn't that long ago. So it's so cool to like reconnect now after you've had big wins on the ground, like incredible stuff. That's just wonderful. I hope I've had a couple big wins at work too, but who knows? We'll see. Let's jump right into the stuff you got done because it sounds like there's a lot. As I understand it, there were three big wins this year in New Hampshire. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. We had a number of these regulatory policies finally after year after year after year of advocacy and testimony and education and getting folks to show up. We finally had a really successful session getting a couple of these big priorities done. And so what ultimately got over the finish line, you know, the big ones, we passed House Bill 631, which was a homes near jobs bill allowing for residential in commercial zones, specifically focused on office space and retail so that you can create those mixed use districts that folks love and are so ingrained in our whole country's development history, but especially in New England, where so much of our communities and town centers were built prior to zoning. We see them all the time and then we made them illegal to build, even though they're some of the favorite places. So getting that over the finish line was fantastic. We expanded on New Hampshire's accessory dwelling unit law to allow for detached ADUs and attached by right. Previously in New Hampshire, you had to allow for attached ADUs, and that we passed about 10 years ago and was one of the earlier states to do any sort of statewide zoning change, and then didn't touch it for 10 years, but finally came back and allowed for detached and attached to be by right. So we got rid of those discretionary hearings that folks know can sort of slow down the process and make it riskier. And then we passed parking reform. And so now no municipality can recover or can require more than one spot per unit. Certainly they could build more if they want to, but a blanket across the board, no matter what you're building, whether it's an ADU or a larger multifamily, can't require more than one. And then there were a number of other bills that got through that are going to make some real impact around the edges. Those, I think, are some of the most visible and most impactful ones. But it was really great to see the coalition of folks who worked on sort of those three bills to stick together and pass a whole bunch of really exciting stuff.
Yeah, the coalition side is so critical. And I mean, that's kind of our like organizing philosophy, right? Is Welcoming Neighbors Network is this coalition model. And you have coalition partners here from 603 Forward with Matt and New Hampshire Youth Movement with Grace. So I'd love if y'all could speak to how that coalition came together. Like, was this something that had been kind of organized in prior sessions and you just re-upped? Or what was how'd you decide who was there this go round?
I'll jump in. I think the coalition was also built just because there was such a high demand for something to happen. Like, folks, the number one issue in a lot of Granite Staters, poll after poll shows that folks wanted some progress on the housing issue. And then the coalition was built by elected leaders and advocates who identify this as an issue in their community and pressured folks to do something about it. And also, like, at 603 Forward, our theory of change is to get more young people elected into positions of power and have a seat at the table, because we think that when young people have a seat at the table, they're more likely to, or they will, take action and address the issues that matter most to young folks. So the coalition also had a lot of young people in it. I think one of our proudest things is that the three bills that we like to celebrate were really championed by young folks and sponsored by young folks. And then we were thinking about who we wanted to have in the coalition, who we were talking to. It was really like an all of the above approach because it touched everyone from so many different sectors. But there was a lot of work around educating folks as to how maybe this would affect them. But yeah, that's, I think, some of my big takeaways from building our coalition.
I want to pick at that, like, the younger folks' involvement, because that's so cool. And obviously, both of y'all representing constituencies that Grace and Matt, I'm over here motioning to my screen as if, like, y'all can see it, or as if a podcast listener could. Like, in Texas, I think you see a lot of young people on the front lines of the advocacy in, like, a private capacity. But there's, I think one of the things that struck me as so unique in New Hampshire is this focus, like, at the coalition level on young people's voices, where, like, in Texas, it was the more traditional, a lot of, like, oh, we've got the industry groups, oh, we've got the housers, oh, we've got the, you know, like, the, like, more the folks you think of when you're going to the Capitol and you're putting on your stuffy suit and you're doing whatever, right? And despite so many young people being interested and involved in housing and, you know, urbanism broadly and whatever else. And I think that is so neat that y'all do that, especially because, like, when you hear about where people are moving right out of college and whatever else, you hear a lot about these, like, oh, they're going to Austin sometimes even, you know, or San Francisco or wherever. It's not always New England in the public consciousness. But y'all have this really cool thing where you're elevating and giving institutional capacity to younger people trying to make a difference. And that is incredible. And Grace, I'm wondering, so you're with New Hampshire Youth Movement, right? And what's your whole model there?
Yeah, so we work primarily with college students in the state, and that's actually how I got involved. I started working with NHYM in 2020 when I was a junior in college. And we also work with young people, like fresh graduates and stuff. And I feel like that's kind of like where our housing work means so much to me. When I was in college, I had a lot of friends that had to either move back out of state or just leave New Hampshire in general, even if they grew up here, because it was just so expensive to live here. And that's something that's still happening nowadays. And so we're really just very focused on getting young people to work and, like, advocate for the issues that are really affecting them in their day-to-day lives. And a big part of that is education, because, I mean, you talk to the average college student and they're like, zoning, like, that doesn't, that's not affecting me at all. But it really is, especially when you graduate, and it's really going to dictate, like, where you live, how your community is going to look like, and everything like that. And so, yeah, we do, like, a lot of just, like, educating and energizing and just, like, empowering young people to really learn and make change for themselves, and focus a lot on, like, peer-to-peer interactions. That's, like, really important to us.
the peer-to-peer aspect is so, I think, important, not just for young folks, of course, but like what it does is it creates a resonance in at the level of identity, you know, like you don't have to worry about does this person have my best interest? Who is this person? Are they part of my community? Like there's a very visible sense of that. I mean, and similarly with like legislators and professional advocates at the capitals that we all work in, is like the reason they respect an industry leader is because they know they've done it. And similarly with young people, I mean, like that's so critical. I just think it's amazing. As you were going into this session, which came first? Was it like the policy package that you then presented to a coalition, or was it like get the coalition together, see what we want to do, and build the policy from there?
It was a really interesting session for this, all of this coming about, and that a number of these bills had been brought forward in previous years and did not move forward. We had some sort of modest parking reform get through in the last session, but quite frankly, a lot of these bills had crashed and burned in previous sessions with, you know, either big votes, big bipartisan votes in opposition, you know, big fiery four fights, these things that just you keep chipping away at it. And so what was really exciting with this coalition is there have been a number of folks who have been working on these issues for years coming together. And so folks knew who they could talk to. And so in addition to the groups we have here, and part of the network, there were also the realtors, the business and industry association, the chambers of commerce, the home builders, some of the libertarian groups, some of the other social justice groups. And so you had this really broad group of folks who were all aligned. Maybe they weren't all talking to each other every day of the week about what was going on, but we all were aligned on where we needed to go. And so that made it so that folks could have targeted conversations with people with who they trusted and who they had those trusted messengers. And so when we were passing these bills, you know, almost all of them passed with, you know, about half of the Republican caucus and about 2/3 or so of the Democratic caucus, at least in the House. The Senate numbers were a little bit different. And then some passed on voice votes and didn't even get the roll call because there was so much momentum for them. But folks coming together, knowing where we had to go, that alignment was really helpful. And we had some sort of lower hanging fruit here. We felt like, you know, the ADU bill, incredibly popular. We had had some stress tests in previous sessions, the homes near jobs. Like these are bills that concepts that like pull off the charts with every single demographic. And so being able to bring the activists together, bring the organizations together, and bring that group of legislators together really, you know, built that muscle over time. And so it, some ways it felt like, oh, how did this happen overnight? And you had such a successful session. And the reality is it took years and years to get here to a place where folks were educated, comfortable with the topics, had that trust. And it didn't mean, you know, there are many folks here who work on bills together in this space that disagree adamantly on a whole bunch of other things. And, you know, we had our issues with some state budget funding and some other pieces that it wasn't a perfect session, but on these issues, you had that alignment and people were able to trust each other, work together. And it was really exciting to see it all come together.
There's something about this issue area where it's always bipartisan, where it's like, whether it dies in flames or makes it to the governor's desk, it's always bipartisan, which I think is great and probably says we're doing something right. It's like, it's not, especially with partisan politics like they are right now, you know, it's like, okay, it's probably great if your issue is not falling into one of those two camps neatly. I am not super familiar with the legislative context in New Hampshire, so I would love if y'all could like tell me like I'm an infant trying to understand the context, because I imagine it's pretty different from where I am, but I have no idea how.
Opening a huge can.
I love it. I'm like, I got my can opener ready, Matt. I'm like, let's do it.
Yeah, it's so funny. Usually when people are like, oh, the New Hampshire legislature, they're like, you guys have a huge legislative body, don't you? That's what most folks start with. But Grace and Nick, feel free to chime in. I'll just start us. But yeah, New Hampshire's legislature is very unique. It's the, I think, third or fourth largest in the English speaking world. It's 400 people. Every bill gets heard in committee and gets a floor hearing. And it's a volunteer citizen legislature. For those 400 folks, they make $200 for a 2-year session. But they're also incredibly accessible. We're able to do a lot of this advocacy work and connect folks directly to their state reps with their phone numbers and emails. And oftentimes you'll just see them around town because you have so many of them. But yeah, it definitely makes for a unique environment. For that's for sure. That's for sure.
As Ben said, it's 400 state reps, it's 24 state senators, and right now there's a Republican trifecta, so controlling the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. And that uniqueness of the volunteer legislators with very limited to no staff, direct conversations. It's also a much older, the average age in the House is about 66. And so, the work of 603 Forward and the Hampshire Youth Movement is so important to get young voices both in the seats and in front of the legislators. But it does make a really interesting sort of messaging and advocacy strategy because you also need to speak to these folks who may have come from a local planning board or zoning board or select board, or maybe they bought their home in the 1980s or 90s or 70s in some cases. And so you're dealing with some structural pieces too that make it challenging and messaging to folks about what it's like to stay in their communities as they age in place. Maybe they want an accessory dwelling unit, talking about their kids and wanting them to come back, or the implications of it has on their favorite diner or restaurant of not being able to have the workforce downtown that the places they frequent. So you have to sort of tailor your messages to the dynamics of the legislature, which is definitely unique. And New Hampshire's motto is "Live Free or Die," and there is definitely that libertarian "Live Free or Die" ethos in both parties here. And when you move here, you just get a—I guess you just get a little bit of it, and it starts to jump into a whole bunch of sort of thought process here. And that property rights argument, that looking out for each other, the all the pieces there coming together, making a really interesting dynamic under the dome.
It's certainly very different from Austin. I was when you said 400 something, I thought I never want to deal with that in my life. Y'all have such so much harder of a job there because you've got more cats to herd. That's remarkable. And I was curious about the population in New Hampshire, and it looks like it's like 1.5 million, right? Which is like roughly the size, a little smaller, I think, than the Austin metro. Which is crazy because we have, we have 150 reps in the Texas legislature and I think 31 senators. So more senators, fewer reps. And it's a pain in the ass. And for the exact reasons you're expressing, the good parts of having more people is that it's like it can be so inaccessible when you're talking millions of people as your constituents, right? And I mean, similarly, like we don't pay our legislators well. They get something like, I think it's like 8 grand for, every year, or maybe it's even every session year. It's like not enough to live on. And so we do get a similar thing where you have a lot of older or wealthier folks in these chambers of power. And it can be sometimes difficult to get them to, and I don't want to impugn anyone's motives, but to like listen to voices that aren't theirs, because they don't know who to trust or what communities are actually facing because it's just not their lived experience, whether Republican, Democrat, anywhere in between, and I'm wondering how y'all do that because simultaneously, like you have this really wonderful youth focus and like, and that maybe is a product of having to fight that. And then you've got a legislature that, as you're saying, is like, probably disproportionately to the population, older. And how do you create that concern, in general, let alone in just housing? But how do you do that? If you have an answer, I know that's like a how do you fix the world's problems kind of question.
I mean, a couple unique things that we've seen is that even the polling here across the board, folks cite housing as a major issue. And Grace and Matt could speak certainly to some of the stories of young people, and that definitely sort of can trickle up. And as folks think about their own kids and them wanting them to move back and have a place in New Hampshire too. But, you know, when we look at some of the numbers, the increases have been so significant that it is starting to cut through across the board. And as legislators are in their communities, they're hearing about it. They're hearing about property taxes and the challenges that folks are facing with seniors trying to stay in their communities, either on fixed income and dealing with, you know, rising assessed values and what that means for their property taxes, or, you know, in their life as they're thinking about, okay, I may own a couple acres in a rural area, but I don't want to be mowing that lawn or shoveling that driveway in the snow. And I would love to still stay near my friends or near my kids or near my job. And so how can I downsize, and looking around and seeing that that just doesn't exist. And because it's not there. And if it's there, the rents have gone up 30-40% over the last 5 years. And so, you know, you're hearing this more and more where it's not just an issue that's affecting a some section of the population. It's certainly really acute for that population and they have nowhere else to turn. And that's a huge issue, but it is really starting to cut through in a lot of ways. And I do think that helped sort of turn the tide on folks who may have voted against some of these bills in the past to finally start to see it in their own life, in their own community. And actually, even if it's not as acute, start to feel it in a way that motivated that action.
Yeah, I feel like it's been really interesting to see like the aging population and then also recent grads have the same issue. Of like, we can't find a small starter home that's affordable on a limited income. I mean, like, I think that the issue is just like becoming, as Nick was saying, it's like just becoming so clear. It's inescapable because you have, I mean, people like me, like I graduated college and I had a full-time job that started right afterwards, but because of my student loans and the cost of housing, I had to move back in with my parents. And it was just like that, like it just wasn't even an option to not do that. And just like seeing, you know, people do like the quote unquote right things with their life and like still like not being able to have a home. I feel like the problem has just become inescapable. Like, it's just so undeniable in New Hampshire that we're facing a housing shortage, and also just like the affordability is nowhere to be found. And so I really think that's, yeah, it's just been absolutely, absolutely wild.
There is something about that like arc of life that is in a lot of places where like the people just trying to get their footing and the folks who are, you know, looking to retire share that struggle, which is I think it's like obviously we wish nobody had the struggle, but I'm really glad that there's a cross-generational resonance there, because otherwise it could become so divisive in different ways.
And when you start to put some like specific income numbers to it too, that's also when people's mind really gets blown. And like right now, to afford the median home price in New Hampshire, you need a household income of like $170,000-$180,000. To afford the median two-bedroom rent, you need to be making $75,000, which is like $34-$35 an hour for a full-time job. And so like you're starting to explain this to people and you can start to see why, you know, over half the population's renter population is cost burdened and putting more than 30% of their income, or they're not making it work. And, you know, so once you sort of get beyond that, like, that can't be true response from some legislators, then they'll be like, okay, well, actually, you know, my son or daughter got a good education. They have a great job and they're living with me and they can't find a place. Like, this is unacceptable. And Grace is totally right that story is motivating, but it's also not unique. And a lot of folks are facing it because the math just doesn't work in this economy and with everything that's going on. And you're hearing it from the business community too. I think that's another big voice that started to resonate with lawmakers when you have, you know, employers who are coming in and saying, we just cannot hire, or we are offering good jobs and they're trying to relocate here, but they can't find a place and they're turning it down. And that's, you know, it's not healthy for our communities. It's not healthy for our economy. And it's, you know, really, really long-term troubling trend that we have to address.
I also think it's like the power of stories and advocacy. You know, like when we bring, like we ran this very big story collection campaign, and when you're sharing things with legislators or decision makers about folks having to drive 3 or 4+ hours to like get to work because they can't find a place to live there, or people who are living out of their cars so that they can make snow in the winter at ski resorts. And you hear these stories, it's hard to, yeah, not think about the folks that you know and how close they could be to those types of situations. And I think, yeah, like collecting those stories, finding ways to get them to these decision makers, and then ultimately the work of, you know, our organizations to get these folks to be able to come to hearings and testify or share their story is always so powerful.
You're speaking my language, Matt, because I'm like, I like self-branded as like a storyteller for, it's still in my bio, I'm sure. I haven't updated that in a long time. But I self-branded that way because I was like, I knew the science of story and like how it acts on the brain and how it can create, you know, it opens pathways for empathy, I think, a lot of times. And much to your point, what we often run into is like not so much disagreement on the importance of story, but like questions on how do you do that? And like, it can seem really cumbersome to some folks, and like, is it worth the returns? And my position is always like, yes, like this is the work. Yes, this is what you do. But it would be super helpful if y'all could share what you learned about how you collect those stories, how you find people, what you're looking for. Because I think those are just like hard skills that we need much more of in the movement.
Yeah. You know, we were looking for honestly anyone's story. It affects, the housing shortage affects all of us. But what we realized is that like just saying to someone like, hey, what's your housing story? Doesn't exactly like prompt or inspire them to really think about the experiences they've had. So we created these little like story collection cards and prompts on a website that ask questions like, you know, how much are you paying in rent? Or how long did it take you to find a place? Really just trying to get folks to think about the situations they've been in. And then when folks would share stories, we did some good old fashioned relational organizing. We'd reach out to them and get to know them and get to just understand their experience a little better. And, you know, not only did that help develop their trust in us and how we would use their stories, but also when we were looking for folks to mobilize around a particular thing or get to show up or sign off on something or share their story in an LTE or something, we were quick to reach out to them. But I think the key is really like getting folks, yeah, to think about their experiences and to think about the different things that they go through. Like I myself, you know, if someone just said to me, what's your housing story? I wouldn't think about the fact that like, I am super fortunate to have my living situation because of a family friend who's able to rent to us. But like, if that could change at any time, and I don't know what I would quite frankly do after that. And that's real because there is a lack of housing. So I would face that housing insecurity. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned LTE, letter to the editor. Is that right?
Yes.
It's such a, those kind of things are so short form sometimes that like, I think the work you're doing to supplement that, like with the data and the stories you're collecting around that is so critical. Like, it's not just like put the 150 word story in the paper and hope it gets published, but it's like, you're looking at the whole person and the whole journey there. That's so cool. That is so, and it's too rare. I'm like, oh my gosh, we need to do this everywhere. Yeah. What did the stories like create any kind of transformative learnings for you as advocates for these policies as you went about them? Or was it more confirmation of like what you felt in your own kind of lived experience and work?
I think it's really helpful to have the stories and the numbers together, right? Is that like you can talk about how this is a huge issue, but like when it's a huge issue across every demographic, then you actually need to put some faces and names and specifics to that. And I think Matt's point about how you collect them, and I know, you know, Grace was doing this too with college students, was like there is could sometimes be a feeling that like, okay, my story isn't as valid as someone else's, or it's not as sort of extreme in a way that deserves for it to be told, or I'm taking someone else's space here in that. And the reality is like that's not true. Like we need everyone's story, and we certainly need stories from folks who are, you know, dealing with extreme and really acute situations. But the fact that someone rented an accessory dwelling unit and that's what kept them here after college before they, you know, were able to rent a two-bedroom apartment and maybe ultimately living with, you know, putting down their roots and starting a family here, like that is just as valid. And that's just as important to be represented at the State House. And it's just as important to be represented in the newspaper and online and everywhere, because like you just don't really think about how zoning or some of these regulatory policies impacts your life until you're actually like, okay, where did I live and how was it possible that that got built? And so breaking through that sort of hesitancy to share was really important. And then figuring out how to plug people in a way that works for them and their schedule. And the legislature is really tough to come testify because it's, you know, during the workday, it's can be hours, and we post a schedule about what bill is going to be heard, but that time can escape really quickly. And so most folks don't have the opportunity to be there for hours and hours and hours at the State House. And so if you can, that's fantastic. And being able to testify, but thinking about posting on social media, sharing a video that, you know, organizations can amplify online, emailing or calling your representative, like all of that stuff, there's not like a silver bullet, but I think what so many organizations in the network and here do so well is trying to put people into a position to succeed and put a position that they can work for their schedule. And that's essential to be able to move this stuff forward.
Yeah, I think much to your point, so many good things there. Much to your point, to that I think some of us, like I know for me, I didn't even realize I was, you know, housing insecure coming out of college, because I was like, well, I've never slept on a park bench, and living in, you know, I lived in New Braunfels, Texas, which is like kind of suburban setting just outside of San Antonio through middle and high school. And so like we didn't have the like collective consciousness and certainly not the language to like understand that the kind of pain and difficulty being felt right out of college or during college too with housing and stuff was actually housing insecurity and part of the same system that creates, you know, homelessness on the extreme end of that spectrum. And it can manifest in those ways, like, oh, if I hadn't had that ADU to live in, or if I hadn't had the person who was willing to rent to me despite not being, you know, qualified or whatever that like precarious situation is, like all of those stories are also part of the housing narrative. And that's that is really, I think that helps craft in that on people who don't understand that so many people they know and love are facing housing insecurity, which sounds like incredible amounts of work that y'all have done to elevate that. And there's a justice component to what you're doing too, where you're talking about trying to get people's voices heard who can't make it to the legislature and do whatever else. Like there's like, you have to make sure those voices are in the room somehow. And institutionally, these legislatures are not always built to bring them to the room. Whether that's intentionally or not, who knows? You know, we can all have various opinions grounded in various amounts of fact on that. But the work y'all do as advocates to bring them even virtually into that space is a matter of justice. And I think that's so incredible to do that. I want to dig into like what you learned as a result of this process. I know that there's I can imagine, especially in a state like New Hampshire, too, there's like a lot of influence from like leagues of cities and some of those like local partners. You mentioned, I think, Nick, earlier, like planning board members and a lot of relationship strongly between the local officials and the state house. When you're talking, you know, 1.5 million people in the state, that's probably a lot more intimate than like, you know, Sacramento to the rest of California or Austin to the rest of Texas, right? How did you navigate those relationships? Because I know they're so fraught in so many states.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, it really, like, it definitely took a lot of work, a lot of broad trusted messengers who are out there making the case. And it really did. And we talked earlier about how it took years and some of these bills had crashed and burned before. And that would have helped us build forward on these and learning what were some of the arguments that were being used to oppose these bills and how do you start to break them down? And, you know, we certainly, you know, in New Hampshire, we have a municipal association, which is similar to the League of Cities and some other states. And that local control argument is tough. I mean, it's one that is sort of grounded in, there's a lot of sort of New England town meeting, all that history there that can make it challenging, but, you know, really, and that overall fear of change, I think, is really tough too, right? Is that like that just change period can be tough. And so when you have folks that don't, you know, always understand sort of every dynamic of every piece of policy, and how could you as a legislator, when you're voting on thousands of bills, know the nuts and bolts of everything, is that there's often sort of that default to being careful about what you're doing. And so there's a lot of education that went into it. But, you know, what we found in addition to the stories was like when you start to talk about the specifics about what these bills do and help people visualize it, that's when we weren't having like a macro debate about, you know, the philosophy of local control. Like we were talking about, should you be allowed to convert your barn into an accessory dwelling unit? Like that is a conversation that is actually what this bill does. And that is one that we could win. And the same thing goes with the Homes Near Jobs bill. When you're talking about, you know, wouldn't you love to see some apartments on top of this aging strip mall? We have the infrastructure there. If we build more densely where there's infrastructure, we can keep our open spaces, the rural parts of New Hampshire that we all love. And so you start to visualize, you start to be specific, and that's when we can start to make progress and start to move these things forward in a way that, you know, addresses some of the barriers that we've had in the past and you know, that we certainly will continue to have as more ideas come forward.
Yeah, the local control argument comes up time and time again. And I think sometimes it's overstated how important that is in the process, but it definitely varies so much jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And you know, in Texas, our legislature has a long and incorrectly proud history of shitting on its cities. But you find when you're on, you know, in the background, there is a lot of like built up trust between municipal leagues and municipal officials and their reps and senators, right? I mean, a lot of times they come from the same pool of people who are vying for political office at various points in their career and whatever else too, which makes a lot of sense. But it's real. And I think it seems like y'all did a good job of avoiding it being kind of a referendum on local control as an issue, really pointing to what the outcome is, which is something agreeable to everybody, right? Something that certainly when you're facing the housing market that we're all facing, and y'all are certainly facing in a very strong way, you can't avoid better solutions at some point. You got to be like, okay, so we got to do something, you know, if we're past the point of no return. And that seems like a needle to thread, but y'all did it to obviously good results. The trusted messenger thing is so important. And trust has come up a couple times as y'all have been explaining the work. Is this like a coalition-wide belief in trust conceptually with the relationships between, you know, partners and legislators and community members? How do you conceptualize that framework if you have a way of thinking through that?
That's a really interesting question. I mean, I think across the board in so many of these issues, you need to have that trust even just get in the door. And there's an element of, you know, New Hampshire being a small state and people being really accessible. And I think Matt had mentioned this, where it's like with 400 state reps, you often are running into folks at the grocery store or at the post office or, you know, at a breakfast place downtown. And so they need to be able to also justify what they, their votes that they took. And so being able to clearly explain what's going on, do it in a way that's, you know, not hyperbolic, that is based in reality, that is based in solutions, is really helpful. And, you know, I think one of the things that the coalition did really well is we listened to the folks who were making these decisions, these legislators, about what they were hearing, what issues, what questions did they have. And by building such a broad coalition, there was a lot of different folks who were able to reach out to someone that they trusted. And the folks that trust Matt and Grace may not be the same folks that trust the Chamber of Commerce and may not be the same folks that trust Americans for Prosperity, right? But like, they trust somebody, and all these folks were supportive of many of the same bills in this setting. And so the fact that we were getting that information in, that people were able to share out facts and key points and ways to explain this, I think was critical to keeping that coalition together, keeping the votes there, and making sure that folks felt proud of what they voted for and were willing to go to the well when they're speaking on it to speak to it, and willing to speak to it when they're at the doors during the next campaign too.
Yeah, I feel like there was also just like, ideologically, we were working with people like, we're working with people that like just like could not be more different than us. And I think a big part of why that was still successful is there was just like a trust there that was like, we're going to assume that we all have the best intentions about this. We're not going to try to throw each other under the bus, and we're going to work towards this common goal. We've all identified this problem, and for once multiple sides agree on the same solution, and we know that we have to get this through. And so I really do think like trust and respect was just like absolutely huge in getting all this done. Both like on like the advocate side, but also like on the legislator side as well.
Yeah, that feels really, really critical. Like, this political moment is so hot. It's any kind of violation of trust seems like it could fracture the whole thing, right? Because then it gets like wrapped into the rest of the partisan ideological breaks, and we're like, see, they're just bad people. You know, we're looking to confirm our priors. So really keeping those intentions on lock feels like even more critical to not have slip-ups or stuff like that in this moment, which doesn't seem to be cooling off anytime soon, unfortunately. I don't think we'd used the term trusted messenger on the show before, like for all the listener audience, but like, I'm so glad you said that. I think Nick, you said it first, because it's a term we use a lot, like in the movement space, but like that really is kind of the core of how you convey all this, whether that's conveying, you know, poll results or a story or whatever else. Like, you're trying to show like, I'm someone worthy of your trust. I'm someone who will be honest with you. You can understand why I'm doing this work, and I trust that you're going to receive it. And that can be an incredibly difficult thing to come in and practice when you come in a door, like the doors to our capitals, which makes it all the more imperative to do that. I know y'all did a lot of this talking about kind of perceiving the stories and the perceptions of the public. Y'all did some polling, correct?
Yes. Yeah, we did. And that was really helpful. I mean, it's one of those things where you get to these rooms and these testimonies and the emails and the outreach, and we've talked about all the proactive stuff that we try to do, but there's also the reactive folks and people that are pushing back on some of these policies. And one of the things that we remind legislators and really any sort of policymaker is that the loudest voice is not the majority in all situations, right? And so while it's really important for folks and to mobilize and be loud and be in the rooms because that still makes a difference, it's also important to look at the entirety of the situation and being able to pull some of these specific ideas and bring that to legislators and say, look, Democrats, independents, and Republicans all agree that it should be easier to build an ADU in the backyard, or they all agree that they would like to see smaller lots so that you could have access to starter homes. And so you're able to sort of bring that data to give people the confidence that they are making a decision that is in line with the people of New Hampshire. And I think that's really important because, you know, so much of the world is political and they want to be making a decision that they think is right, good policy, but also popular. And so having that data, I think, was critical. I don't think it would have been done, you know, in a vacuum if it was the only thing out there. It's not a silver bullet, but it was great to be able to test some of the specifics and bring that to legislators because we have, you know, there's polling done through the University of New Hampshire and St. Anselm College to, you know, both higher education universities here in the state that had consistently shown housing as like the top issue facing voters. But, you know, sort of housing as the top issue and specific proposals can be two very different questions. And so being able to back that up was key. And, you know, ultimately we heard, you know, legislators in committee rooms or on the floor of the body talking about the popularity of these issues as validation for their colleagues to support it. And so that was a huge piece of the puzzle too.
Yeah, you're so right about the connecting the goal of build more housing broadly to like the, what does it actually look like? What is the policy proposal itself? That's a dot that's difficult to connect. And with the polling, it gives you not only a good sense of opinion, but like some cover to be like, okay, I am doing something people want. No matter how many people are in my office shouting from XYZ group, like I know that the broader constituency of people from New Hampshire want this, need this, you know, and that's really incredible. I think y'all have done an outstanding job of creating this kind of shared identity that's generous enough to include people of diverse ideological stripes and backgrounds while still being concrete enough to accomplish a set of real policy goals. And that's really phenomenal. I hope more people hear this and, you know, take that example, because that's what all the behavioral science, all the psychology tells us matters. And it matters, and not just in the sense of like getting a policy win, but like making a better state, a better country is like these are the long work of doing that. And I think that's just phenomenal.
And I think kind of one point, sorry, just to jump. So one point I think on that I think is really important is that we often get asked, and, you know, we're having a discussion right now about sort of the tactics and the strategy and all the things that we did. And you get asked, well, how did you do it? Like, what was the message? And all that's important. But like at the end of the day, the people of New Hampshire wanted this. And that is what we were trying to make sure the policymakers knew, is that young people, that our businesses, that seniors, they needed this and they wanted this and they were not okay with the status quo. And so, you know, we can sort of help shape that. And there are a lot of other organizations that were obviously also moving that forward. And we weren't, again, all pulling the strings behind the scenes. It wasn't like a meeting that we would have a cabal and come back like, this is what we're all going to do. But like the people in New Hampshire were really clear that they wanted some change and they needed some change. And the numbers backed it up and the stories backed that up. And so what so many folks were able to do was help make that happen. But at the end of the day, the people wanted this and the people needed this. And that's, I think, really important for folks to keep in mind with any messaging at any level in any community.
Yeah, beautiful to keep that centered. I think that's so important. We're coming up close on time, so I want to open some space here. And I would love to hear from each of you what's next and what you're excited about following these wins. And whoever wants to go first can go. I won't pick on anyone.
I'm ready. I can jump in. I think one thing I'm looking forward to is just continuing to build and strengthen and support our coalition. And also just looking forward to seeing these wins like trickle down into the cities and just across the state. 603 Ford, we're super proud to have helped get over 400 young people elected to offices from school board, the city council, the state house, and state senate. So I'm looking forward to working with them in their various capacities on some of the pieces of this that see these improvements in their towns and cities. And also just looking forward to the big ideas that come from future young electeds in the state house.
Yeah, I think one thing I'm really excited for next year for NHYM is more of a focus on educating and having conversations with our endorsed candidates. As an organization, we endorse people that are running for issues that young people care about. And all of our candidates are big housing supporters, but also have asked for and like need a lot more education, because like this is like a bit of a complicated topic. And so we're really looking forward to doing more education with them, connecting them with more young people so they can hear their stories and like bring those into the work that they're doing at the state house.
Yeah, I'm definitely excited to continue having these groups all working together in a direction that's positive. And then really excited to see the implementation and the ultimate new housing that comes on because of these bills. And I think so often folks celebrate when something gets signed, but the celebration should be when somebody has a roof over their head that didn't have one before this bill was passed or these bills were passed. And so I think continuing to move that forward and then seeing these through all the way to the end is something that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, it's a lot to look forward to. I'm excited for whatever y'all do next. It's going to be a lot of fun to watch, and maybe I'll be a little more involved, hopefully. Because I love it. And I need to make a trip to New Hampshire is what I learned. That I learned for sure.
Yeah, we got
to
get you up there for the foliage.
Yeah,
some leaf peeping.
Well, just incredible stuff. And so grateful to all three of you for coming on, giving some more time after a long, good fight in the ledge to come and share those stories and learnings with folks who listen to the podcast and with the Welcoming Neighbors Network. It just means a lot. You're incredible. I see why Allison demanded I have all three of you on. I'm glad this is our first threefer episode. So
we had to set a good standard for the first three, and as opposed to just talking over each other the whole time. So, and Cutter, thanks for you doing this, and for the Welcoming Neighbors Network for giving the platform to share successes and share best practices and what worked, what didn't work, so that we can all learn together. Because I mean, this really is, New Hampshire and Texas could sometimes feel like they're so different from each other, but at the same time, there's so many of the same dynamics and challenges that we're all facing. So really appreciate the platform to come out and share.
Yeah, no, I had to say the same thing. Like, thank you to the Welcoming Neighbors Network. Y'all are, shout out for you guys. Amazing. Thank you. And looking forward to seeing you guys at Gimby Town.
Yes, I hope y'all will all be there. I'm excited. My birthday is day two, so be ready.
Party for
prepared. We're partying. We're partying in New Haven. Well, thank you so much, Nick, Grace, Matt. We'll talk soon, and we'll look forward to whatever you do next.
Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you so much.
There's so much we could talk about together, and this episode really only scratched the surface. These three are leaders in the movement, and thank goodness for that. And when you think of the type of leaders people want to follow, these are the folks that should come to mind. That said, here's how you can virtually follow them and or their work. Matt Mushian is on all social media at Matt Mushian. That's M-A-T-T-M-O-O. S-H-I-A-N. 603 Forward is on all social media as well at 603Forward, and their website is 603Forward.org. Grace Murray is on Twitter at Grace_Elyse. That's GRACE_ELYSE. New Hampshire Youth Movement is on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at NH Youth Movement. You can also visit their website, which is nhyouthmovement.org. And last, but certainly not least, Nick Taylor is on Twitter at NTaylorNH. That's NTaylorNH. Housing Action NH is on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at Housing Action NH. Their website, likewise, is housingactionnh.org. As always, you can connect with the Welcoming Neighbors Network online at welcomingneighbors.us and on social media. We are at WNN Pro Housing on Instagram and at welcomingneighbors.us on Blue Sky. The Stoop is produced in-house at the Welcoming Neighbors Network by me, Cutter Gonzalez. The music for our show was created by my friend Nolan Hopkins. If you have ideas for our show, including special episodes, guests you'd like to hear from, or topics you'd like to cover, shoot me an email at cutter@welcomingneighbors.us or DM me on social media. My handle is at CutterWGonzalez across all platforms. Thanks for joining us on The Stoop. Talk to y'all real soon.